streaming worldwide at lakeshorepublicradio.org. It's time for Midwest Beat, a program all about music and the people who make it. I'm your host, Tom Lounges. This two-hour show will have two guests. Coming up on the second hour, Chicago's Queen of the Blues, Shamika Copeland, is back with us. Shamika's got a brand new album called Uncivil War, and it's all about what's going on in the headlines today, as well as some other things. We'll be talking with Shamika on the second hour, so stay with us. Coming up this hour, I'll be calling Jolly Old England, and we'll be talking to rock legend Mick Box. Mick is the guitarist of Uriah Heep. They've got a brand new 23-album box set. We'll talk all about it and play classic Uriah Heep. It's up after your headlines. Good afternoon, everyone. Tom Lounges here. It's time for Midwest Beat. Coming up second hour, Chicago's Queen of the Blues, Shamika Copeland, will join us by phone. And we're going to be calling England many minute now. We're going to be talking to Mr. Mick Box. He is the co-founder, guitarist, and original member of Uriah Heep. Uriah Heep have a brand new box set coming out. It's called 50 Years in Rock. Yeah, it's been a long time. 23 albums have been curated, along with four CDs that individual members have picked songs for. We're going to be playing the Mick Box picks and talking to Mick about this anniversary in just a moment. But for those of you saying, gosh, I know Uriah Heep's name, I'm trying to remember a song, let's give you a little medley of all those right now. Uriah Heep, give me a little sample of what's on this 23 CD collection, 50 Years in Rock. And let's start off by letting the music do the talking as we get ready to make contact with England and Mr. Mick Box. Let's go back to the Free and Easy album. This is Free and Easy. We'll be right back. Free and easy, Uriah Heep. And we've got Mick Box joining us. And is Mick there?
I'm here, mate.
Hi. Hi, Mick. Thank you for joining us all the way from England, where I believe it's evening time, isn't it?
It is evening time indeed. It's just about 7 p.m., 10 past 7.
Well, I hope we're not interrupting your dinner.
No, no. Once we finish, I will sit down quietly and eat.
All right. We are celebrating 50 years of Uriah Heep. And what a way to do it. You guys don't pull any punches. You're putting out this amazing box set, 23 CDs. And if that wasn't enough, you guys curated your own independent personal favorites, which fans always want to know. What's your favorite song from your catalog? And you've chosen 15 of them, and we're going to play some of them, like the one we just did, Free and Easy. So let's talk about 50 years of Uriah Heep. You've been there all along. Did you ever think it would become a half a century project and still going strong?
Of course not. you never know, you know, how things are going to work out. But, you know, it's a wonderful achievement. We're very proud of it. And, you know, what an accolade to be able to say that, we've made 50 years. And it's just a marker because we're still going on. We're still looking at new albums, looking at new tours. Hopefully when COVID-19 disappears into the ether and we can get back to doing what we love best, and that's being out on the road.
Right, right. So when was the last time you were actually out on the road? I mean, COVID hit us around February, March, at least here in the States. I'm not sure when it hit England.
About the same time, but we had just came off one of those Rock Legends boat things that went from Fort Lauderdale, I would think, the Cayman Islands or whatever, and back again with loads of bands on. It was fantastic, you know. We're really high off that because we were coming back to Europe to do a whole year of touring and a celebration of the 50th anniversary. And of course, that all fell to bits.
Right. Now, you recently released an album, I want to say 2019, Living the Dream, which is on Frontiers. And Frontiers has become quite the home for a lot of 70s and 80s rockers. We've found all these different groups that are kind of finding a home there, a shelter, so to speak, to keep their music alive, because the Italian label and Europe in general is still very respectful to the older artists, unlike fickle America, where sometimes, you know, the latest things are kind of dismissed in favor of the old ones. So what has it been like outside of the States for Uriah Heep's music as far as with the new releases like Living the Dream?
Well, we've had such great response from Living the Dream, from both the media and the fans alike, and even to the point where they're saying that, you know, it's one of the best of our career now. Coming up to 50 years, that's quite something, you know,
right,
to get those sort of accolades. So, you know, we're absolutely delighted with it. And we do tours, you know, world tours, and, you know, we play in 62 countries, so we really do get out there and tour.
Now, that album, Living the Dream, and prior to that you did Outsider, and there was one prior to that, and you had written most of the songs on the Outsider. Living the Dream, it looks like you're stepping back a little bit from the songwriting side. How has that affected the sound of the band?
Well, I was co-writer with our keyboard player, Phil Lanson, and we've written the last few albums for the last few years, to be honest. But on this particular Living the Dream, we just had one song that David Rimmer brought along that he co-wrote with Jeff Scott Soto. And it was such a good song, we had to put it on the album. So it's only one song. The rest of them were all written by me and Phil.
Okay. So when is the next studio album planned? Obviously, everything's been sidelined with COVID and plans are a little in flux. But what's the follow-up to Living the Dream and when do you anticipate starting on that?
We're actually looking at going in on February 2021 to record a new album with the same producer, Jay Rustin, who was fantastic on Living the Dream. We've got everything booked. Now it's down to whether we can do it, you know, with all the peaks that are happening with the virus all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, is it the same lineup that you had with Russell and Davey and Phil? And Bernie, of course.
Yeah, of course. We're pretty solid now.
Okay. The thing about Uriah Heep that is pretty amazing is that you guys have had such a revolving door, so to speak, of different members, kind of like Savoy Brown. I had Kim Simmons on recently, and we were talking about
that. Yeah, good.
it's like so many different people have come and gone, yet the Uriah Heep as a group, as an entity, has remained strong and steadfast, despite who's in or who's out. What's the secret of that? We've seen so many bands when they lose a key member, and they fall apart. You have somehow maintained all of this. How have you chosen the right replacements when people do leave?
I think it's a couple of things, really. You know, if I'm there, then the heart and soul of the band will always be there. And I think that the caliber of musicians that we've had come through the band, in and out the band, have been of the highest caliber. And I think that's kept the bar high for Uriah Heep music all the way through our career. But, you know, choosing players is difficult because it's not just choosing the great player. You have to choose a person you're going to spend a lot of time with over a long period of time, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
You know, go out and do 150 shows a year. You need to be getting on pretty well with each other.
Right.
So, yeah, it's a difficult decision when those things appear. But I've been lucky enough that I've just got that that touch of remembering good people as I go through life. And when it gets difficult, I'll give them a call.
Was there ever a time when you were going through the changes of the band members and changing things around, the sounds were changing and the styles were changing, that you said, maybe we've had enough of a run? I mean, maybe it's time to let the beast go?
There was a little time at the end of our Conquest album, which it's kind of one of those albums kind of people either love or hate. But at that time, I just felt that we weren't going in the right direction with the chemistry of the band as it was, so I dissolved that. And there was a couple of days there where I was uncertain of where I should go and what the next move will be. But that was quickly put to bed when I phoned up my old pal Lee Kerslake, who was actually with Ozzy Osbourne on the first two albums.
Right.
And I said, I was wishing him, you know, good luck to go to America. And he says, I'm not going there. Sharon's decided we want an all-American band. So I said, oh, yeah. Well, I just happened to have a record contract, publishing contract, loads of work, all the equipment, et cetera, et cetera. And he says, well, as long as the other, you know, the other manager wasn't involved that managed us before when he was there, which was his reason for leaving. I said, well, no, I'm looking after it, Lee. And he said, I'm in. So I said, oh, well, that's great. I said, you know, and what's Bob doing? Because Bob's, you know, Australian, and they want an American guy on the bass. So I phoned up Bob, then Bob came on board, and suddenly I was just picking up, you know, a band very, very quickly. And it was just weeks before we were in rehearsal, and we recorded the album of Bombomog, which we did all in rehearsal, and it was just fantastic, you know, as if it had always meant to be, you know, and it was another rebirth of a career.
Mm-hmm. That album did very well, actually. That was, what, 82, 83?
Yeah, it did very, very well. It was top 40 in America, which was lovely. It was at a time when we were releasing videos. You know, MTV was pretty big then with rock bands, and we had high rotation on their video 8 times a day, which was a huge thing at the time. And it was all happening for us. And we went out and did a long tour with Def Leppard, who were the biggest things in sliced bread out in America at that particular time. So it was all go, go, go. And it was a wonderful rebirth.
Now, that was a time also when, I mean, the 1980s, we saw a huge change in popular music tastes with the Duran Durans and the new wave coming in. Everything was keyboard driven. Of course, you guys have always had incredible keyboards in your lineup, but the sound was different. One of the things that I admired about Uriah Heep is you didn't jump on the bandwagon. I mean, even the Stones and Bowie and all these other guys kind of went with that that new wavy sound. You guys stayed true to the Uriah Heep sound. Was that challenging?
Yeah, it was. But, you know, we pampered to it a bit, I have to say, in the 80s, purely because we were being dictated to how people wanted to listen to music, you know, on the radio, etc. And if you remember, you know, go back to Def Leppard again, you had Mutt Lange as a producer.
Right.
And many, many producers like him that spent 2 years making an album. You know, whereas Uriah Heep, 3 months, we're all done, dusted, and ready to go out and play it. So we had to you know, probably go into the production side that people wanted to hear. And I think that if you listen to those 80 albums of Heap, you know, they are very much in that mold, you know, and they sound very 80s production.
Okay. Let's play another song from your picks. You picked 15 songs. We're going to play a couple while we have you here. What is one that you'd like folks to hear?
If I could remember what there was on there, I could tell you.
Well, how about...
I'll tell you what happened. Okay. I'll tell you what happened. I was asked by BMG, a record label, to put some tracks together for a CD of my own personal choice. And I did that, sent them over, and then they sent back and saying, well, there's too many on there, because I had, like, Salisbury off of our second album, the title track, which is like a 20-minute prog rock song, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
With a 27-piece brass and woodwind section on, but I couldn't use that because I had to cut it down. So I tended to choose, because I was thinking, if anybody's going to be asked this, like the other guys, they're all going to go for the favourite tracks, you know, like the Julian Moyes, the Easy Livings, and all the standard stuff that everyone loves.
Right.
So I went for the deeper tracks, and in doing that, I can't remember what the hell they were.
Well, the two that were pretty big radio hits are "Sweet Lorraine," of course, and "Free and Easy," which we played. We definitely will try to get to "Sweet Lorraine" toward the end. But you've got "The Park," "Tears in My Eyes," "Woman of the Night," which is a favorite of mine. "Love and Silence," "Cross That Line," "Straight Through the Heart." So many wonderful songs.
"Woman in the Night" would be a good one.
All right, "Woman of the Night" it is. This is from the Mick Box selection of favorites. And again, this is Uriah Heep's 50 Years in Rock, 23 CDs, 4 CDs curated by its founding members. And this is from the disc curated by my guest, Mick Box. We'll be back with Mick after a moment. "Woman of the Night" coming at you on Midwest Beat.
Down.
Woman of the Night. Taking you back to 1978 in the Fallen Angel album. What a great record that was. In fact, that was the lead track from it, as I recall. A song that was written by my guest, Mick Box. He is the co-founding member of Uriah Heep, celebrating 50 years with a super deluxe box set that's available right now, I believe. It's already out, isn't it, Mick?
I think it is. If not, it's out shortly at the end of the month, for sure.
23 CDs, which is pretty much most of your catalog. I think you're at 25. Is it the whole catalog? Okay.
Yeah.
And four additional CDs. It's got The Magician's Birthday, which to me is your Stairway to Heaven. Magician's Birthday was the most requested song I had from the classic rock, prog rock era when I was doing an overnight show. Everybody wanted to hear that in its entirety. It's like 10, 11 minutes long. And I said, you want to hear the whole song? They're like, yeah, we want to hear the whole song. Probably every night I played that song.
That's really proggy too, huh?
Yeah, it is. That really is. But that's included, of course, but there's some changes to that. There's new artwork from Roger Dean, of course, the legendary artist that did the Heap albums, the Yes albums, and so many others. I think he did some King Crimson. Tell me about that album that's included in the box set.
Well, it's Magician's Birthday, and Roger Dean's kindly done a revamp on the cover. Which looks excellent. You know, his work is just stupendous. It's very, it's stood the test of time, isn't it? Let's be fair.
Yep.
The album's a great album. You know, it was. As you say, we still, up until early this year, played Magician's Birthday on stage. You know, because everyone loved it. You know, and the big jam between the drummer and guitar in the middle, which is a bit of a fight between love and hate, if you like, was always a request. People just loved it. It just resonated with them.
So you said you played it up until this year, or have you pulled it from the set?
Up until this year, yeah. And of course, this year was our 50th anniversary, so we were going to look at doing full shows with just us, you know, with no support band, and more songs in, more history, new stuff and everything, acoustic, the works, but unfortunately it didn't come to fruition. But, you know, hopefully next year it will do, and we can get back on track again.
Okay. One of the things, those of us that discovered Uriah Heep early on, one of the standout members was David Byron. What a voice. He was right there along with the likes of Freddie Mercury and some of the other greats, Robert Plant. And when it came to outstanding, indelible singers, you knew it was Uriah Heep the second he opened his mouth. I mean, of course, you knew because of the organs, too. But his voice was indelible to your sound. You lost him early on, but have replaced him over the years. I shouldn't say replaced, but filled in that slot. With so many great singers, John Lawton, of course, your latest singer, all these guys have come. How hard was it for them to step in to do the early songs? Because it's no one's replaced Freddie. I mean, no one can do Freddie, and no one really can do David.
When you listen to David's voice, I mean, David had the ability to live within a song. It just wasn't a vehicle for the song. He lived within it, and I think that's what resonated with people so much when they heard his voice. It's very believable, and you're right with him from the first note on, you know, that he sings. He's just got an amazing, absolutely amazing, that's technology for you. It's my phone with Siri asking me questions.
Oh.
I'm sorry about this.
Sorry, Siri, it's my turn to ask.
Anyway, David's voice was absolutely superb, and he was the full package. You know, he had the charisma, the stage presence, and the work. So it was always a difficult thing to replace him, of course. But I think we did really well with the vocalist we have chosen, and singing David's songs. I mean, sometimes if I'm perfectly honest, I think when we got to Bernie Shaw, our singer now. When he first came on board nearly 30 years ago, the fans were coming up to me saying, now we've got a Heap singer, because he could cover the songs that David sang very, very well. Mm-hmm. There were times on stage I'd get the hairs stand up on my arm when it could almost be David, because he was right in the pocket with it, you know. So, yeah, he was a hard act to follow, but, you know.
Right.
We just did what we could at the time, and I think we did very well.
Now, with the making of this box, how long was the process? I mean, when did BMG call and say, hey, we want you guys to actually have input into this? How long of a process, how much of your life did it take to go through revisiting all this history and all these great albums and saying, well, I'm going to pick my songs and Lee's going to pick his songs and you know, all the guys are going to do their thing. Paul Newton and Lee Kerslake and Ken Hensley and everybody pulled their own favorites. And I just got to think it had to be a pretty daunting task.
Yeah, I mean, it was probably, you know, between 9 months to a year, to be honest, you know, from the initial idea. And then, of course, you know, they had to get the rights to all the songs, so in all the albums. And then there's a wonderful booklet in there that's pages thick of, you know, old pictures and pictures through the entire every lineup, if you like, and stuff, you know. So, yeah, it was quite a daunting task, but, you know, I was all at the end of the phone, and anything they needed, they had it the next day. So we moved very, very quickly in that regard.
Now, fortunately, Lee was there to help put this together and pick his favorites. We recently lost him last month. What I didn't know he had been sick. Was it sudden? Was he ill? What happened?
Yes, he had a prostate cancer, which was the initial sickness, and he was kind of getting okay with that, and then he had a bit of diabetes, and it just like a, it seemed that everything was coming at him, but, you know, he was a very strong guy. I mean, they gave him 2 years, 5 years ago, if you like.
Wow.
So that shows you how strong and much he put up a fight, but he always had his music. His music was something that kept him alive, kept him going. And he's got his own solo album coming out at some time. You know, and recording that album just kept him going, you know, and he was always vibrant. In fact, my last meeting with Lee was about a week before he passed away, and I went over to his house and we sat down. And as much as his mind was alert and he could talk very well, you could see that the body was in decline. But the minute you talked about music, you know, he came to life. You know, he just absolutely came to life. And I was playing him songs that I'd written for our new album that's coming up, ideas and stuff, and he was just jumped all over him. You know, he loved it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and so, yeah, he put up a good fight, I have to say, and we gave him a sending-off. Bar none, he loved, you know, he would have loved it, you know, and it was a very, very sad day for everyone because, you know, not only was he was a, you know, a great drummer, he was up there with the top five drummers of the world back in the 70s, and then
right.
He was a good writer and he had a great voice. He was also a really, really good human being, you know, he was an incredible guy, and everyone loved him. Everyone loved him. And so it was very sad to see him go. But, you know, he's left a wonderful legacy behind that everyone can still enjoy.
Certainly has. And I can imagine he was very excited to see this 50th anniversary come out and to be a part of it. That had to give him a solid purpose to keep hanging on.
He was proud as punch. Proud as anything. Proud as anything. Absolutely.
So
yeah, he loved it.
Do you still work with Ken at all on any projects? Is everything good with you guys?
No, we've kind of, he's gone a different route, to be honest. He now lives in Spain, and he's a born-again Christian, and he follows his own path with going out and doing solo shows, usually in places like Finland or Russia or whatever, or he goes and does a few shows with a pickup band. So he's just taken his life on there. So with Heap, you know, up until the virus, we're as busy as ever, you know, doing 150 shows a year.
Mm-hmm.
In 62 countries around the world, so you know we don't really have a lot of time, but we do talk by email when there's some historical stuff to discuss, and that's about it, really.
Okay, I've got to ask you because people always ask me, Uriah Heep, what a weird name, and of course it's tied to David Copperfield, a legendary author from England. How did you come to the name? I mean, is there a story behind why you chose that?
Well, we were looking for names when we were in the studio because we were actually called a band called Spice before,
okay.
Which is a four piece, and we went in and recorded. We called Spice because we, you know, in the culinary world, there's many spices, and we want our music to be many flavors. we didn't just want to stick to the one genre. You know, we wanted to put our feet in folk, jazz, rock, blues, everything, you know, metal, everything. We pretty much did that, you know, and our first album really, really shows that to the hilt. So we went into the studio as a four-piece, and we decided to include a keyboard to give the songs more colour. And I was a big fan of Vanilla Fudge. Mark Stein was an amazing keyboard player at the time. It's a Hammond keyboard player, and Hammond fitted every nuance of our music, so that was the choice of instrument. And then we got Ken Hensley involved, who used to be in a band called The Gods with our bass player at the time, Paul Newton. So it was very incestuous, but it all seemed to work, you know. So with the musical template change, we decided to change the name of the band. And it just happened to be the 100th birthday of Charles Dickens, the great novelist who wrote many, many novels, but one of them being David Copperfield. And all over London, of course, you know, on the buses, there were posters, on TV, on radio, and everywhere, you know, celebrating his great literary art, you know, works. And a manager went to take his two sons to a movie to see David Copperfield, and he came back with this name, Uriah Heep, and he was an old Dickensian accountant. He wasn't a very nice person.
Right.
But the name just stuck. And at the time, one of our thinkings were, in those days, you know, of course, Deep Purple and Black Sabbath all around, and their names all started at that end of the alphabet, but ours started at the other end of the alphabet, so we thought, well, in print, that would stand out.
Okay.
So that's why we chose the name.
Yeah, he was kind of a scoundrel of a character, as I recall.
He was indeed. He was a nasty, nasty piece of work, but we tried to ignore that.
One of the songs you've chosen that I'd like to play now actually opens your CD, and it's going back to the Salisbury album of 1971. It was that was the album that I think kind of broke you guys in America. You did very well with that, at least on the FM side of the dial, with songs like Bird of Prey and Lady in Black. Those really I remember hearing on the FM channels back then. You've chosen a song called The Park, which is a little bit of a different sound, and it's one actually written by Ken. And if it's okay with you, I'd like to play that now, and then we'll come back and we'll finish up.
That'd be fantastic.
All right. This is the first song on the Mick Box curated CD that's part of this 23 CD plus 4. I guess it'd be 27 total. So this is The Park, going back a number of years when they were just youngins, 1971. Check out the sound.
Color blue. once he did so, until he died at the hand of needless war.
Taking a trip to the park and a trip back to 1971, a landmark album for Uriah Heep. Mick Box, founding member of that band, joining us today here on Midwest Beat on Lakeshore Public Radio. We are celebrating 50 years of Uriah Heep with a great album, 50 Years in Rock. 23 albums plus 4 albums plus some art cards plus a 64-page book. You just can't get more Uriah Heep in one package than this. And it is out now. And you can find it, I'm sure, on all the usual suspects online. There's a Uriah Heep website, I'm sure. Is there a Uriah Heep website, Mick?
Yes, mate. www.uriah-heep.com.
There you go. And remember, Heep is a double E, folks. It's named after the Dickens character.
Yes, indeed.
Because that's the other thing. People always spelled it wrong. It was annoying to me. Just like with Led Zeppelin, they always leave a P out. It's like, stop it.
Yes.
That album, Salisbury, was a transition for you guys. You go back to the first album, very humble, and or very, very heavy, very humble, as I recall it was. Salisbury was a move more into the prog rock kind of sound, and it was the first time that Ken kind of stepped in as a songwriter. You had done most of the songwriting with David Byron, as I recall, on that first album. This one was giving Ken a little space and giving him his shot. And that song, The Park, obviously a favorite of yours, it was chosen, was written entirely by Ken. What made that transition? Why did you guys suddenly say, oh, you know, maybe we should let Ken in and be part of the team here?
Well, do you know what? You know, I've always been a firm believer of the best songs on the table are the ones that we should use, you know, and Ken had a creative run. And, you know, that song, The Park, actually, if I remember correctly, was written in Hamburg in Germany in a house we were all staying at the time. And it had a harmonium there, and he started writing that there, and I thought, well, that's really cool. And, you know, just listening back to that, you know, they're happy every day, weren't they?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the harmony falsetto work on that particular song and the voices is just stupendous. You know, it's spot on. And the little jazzy bit in the middle is very proggy. But they're the days we're living in. You know, we were just letting our creative juices flow where they needed to flow. And it was only when we got to Look at Yourself, the album after Salisbury, our third mm-hmm. album, that we decided that we wanted to be a straight-ahead rock band. And that's when we started taking off.
That got a little heavier with Look at Yourself and, what was it, Love Machine, I think, was a pretty heavy one.
Yeah, Love Machine and I Want to Be Free and stuff. And it had, of course, the beautiful song July Morning on, which you know, is something that we have to play every show now because, you know, people, they come to a show and don't hear that, then they go away disappointed, you know, and it's a fabulous song. So we love doing it.
When you were sitting back and visiting these songs again, I imagine, you know, always moving forward as you have, you don't rest a lot on the laurels, and you didn't probably revisit a lot of the old stuff. But when the box set was due, I imagine that you had to do a lot of visiting your past. And what was it like for
100%.
You to go back and listen to albums like Salisbury or Look at Yourself, the early stuff, and revisit that? Were you, you know, could you go back and listen and say, boy, I wish we would have changed that or would have done this instead? Or were you happy? I think I, as a fan, think those albums certainly stand up.
For me personally, it was an absolute thrill to listen to it because I don't play our music at all, you know, and I don't only access it when somebody mentions something like BMG, say, what about this, what about that, and I go and listen to it, you know. But I'm always thrilled, you know, of the quality of it. You know, I think it's just fantastic. And I never have those thoughts about we could do this better, could do that better, because I always think things happen for a reason and they're locked in time and that's how they were and that's how they should be from there on in. So yeah, it was an absolute thrill, and I enjoyed every minute of it. And I thought, I can really see, because it's for the first time when you don't listen to it for ages, and you listen to it like a fan, if you like, and rather than being critical about anything. And so yeah, it was a real buzz. I loved it.
What got you?
A lot of good times.
What first brought you to the guitar? When did the guitar and you bond and you said, this is how I'm going to make my living? What was the situation that put you in music?
Well, the love affair started when I was 14 years old, and I picked up a guitar for the first time, and that was it. I was hooked. The feel of it, the smell of it, the look of it, it was just what I wanted to do. And then I started taking some guitar lessons with a guy called Alan Hotchkiss, who used to be Django Reinhardt's second guitarist. And he lived locally in London, and I went to him for loads of lessons, and that was really good, very jazz-orientated, which gave me some of my dexterity, I guess. But that was really, really cool, and once I got that bug, that was it. I was off and running, you know. And I saw a couple of bands in England, and one of them was a band called Johnny Kidd and the Pirates, and they had a guy called, I can't remember his name, on guitar, and he was called the Governor, that's his nickname, and he played a Telecaster, and I don't know if you know a song called Shaking All Over.
Yes, I remember that.
That was just fantastic. And that hooked me in. And then the second band I saw was a band called Them, with Van Morrison singing.
Okay.
And they had a song called Baby Please Don't Go, with a similar sort of riff, you know. It was just magic riffs, and when I heard them too, that was it. I was sold.
and the rest was history.
Indeed.
I
was very, very focused.
One of the things, you are the sole member of Uriah Heep that was there for every album, every incarnation, every era from 1969 to now, and you're still moving forward. Why did you never feel the need, like so many band members do, even if you stay with the band, to do a solo album? David did one, Ken, you know, everybody went on, and of course, even in the Stones, they've all done solo albums. Why have you never felt that need to step outside of Heap?
I have thought about it, I have to say, you know, but we're so busy with Heap, it's never been possible. And the one time it was possible, when I would have thought about it, was at the time David Byron was doing his solo album, but then David wanted me and Lee on it as his safety blanket, if you like. So I said, okay, Dave, I'll come with you, and I'll shelve my ideas and then come with you and write the album with you, which we did. And it was great, and it was a lot of fun, and I think David really enjoyed stepping outside of Heap for a while, and we all did for that moment in time, and it was a good little album, you know. But and then, since then, you know, it's been busy, 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 you know, onwards and upwards all the time, touring. If you're not touring, you're studio or whatever. And I've got to be perfectly honest, you know, when I come home from a tour, I take my rock and roll hat, I put my family hat on. And if I came home and said, right, I'm now going to go into rehearsals for 3 months with guys and record a new album, I think I'll get shot. Because rightfully so, they demand, you know, all your time when you're at home. And I love that, you know. That to me gives me grounding, and I've got no regrets of that at all. You know, if a solo album comes up down the line, I could see the other thing is, I would only do it if I could get a band together, or five guys together, and we went into a rehearsal room, rehearsed it, and we went in the studio and played as a band in the studio. I couldn't do it by sending files to somebody and all that sort of stuff. That doesn't appeal to me at all. Because I think that you lose a lot of the human touch in music that, you know, disappears when you do those sort of things.
All right. Let's project, Mick. This album is out. Your 50 years are now behind you and archived well. You said you're working on a new Uriah Heep album. How long do you anticipate continuing on? You're at a point now where you could sit back on your laurels, put a rocking chair on the porch, and enjoy the rest of your life, you know, just idling along. What keeps you driving?
Too much passion for music. Yeah, passion for playing guitar, passion for writing songs, passion for music in general, and passion for Uriah Heep, you know. So there's no... I mean, my mantra in life, as you do when you get a little older, is, you know, health is wealth. And if you have your health, then you can go on and carry on and do what you want. And And that's the all-important thing. As long as we've got our health, you know, we'll continue being out there playing and writing and doing what we love best.
As a songwriter, this will be my final question. I'll let you go. How have you evolved? If you look back at some of the early albums and your songwriting then, and now your songwriting now, how have you evolved as a songwriter? What are the biggest changes, if there are any?
I don't think there's any real changes. I think you fundamentally go for the same thing. You try and find an attractive riff, chord sequence, or whatever. You try to find a great melody that you know, hopefully people will remember, and you try and write some intelligent lyrics to go with it. You know, it's just fundamentally the same thing every time. It's generally the same approach for me as well, and with Phil Lanz, my co-writer. You know, we'll get our musical ideas together, then we'll do the melody, then we'll do the lyrics. And okay. It's just been the pattern of life, really, for us. You know, it's in our DNA to keep writing and keep performing and keep playing.
All right. Any collections from the Italian label that you're going to be doing as far as a best of or a live album going back to Frontiers Records? Have they been inspired by this BMG collection to say, hey, maybe we should do that?
You know what? They haven't been in contact with us, I have to say. But, you know, seeing that this is all possible, who knows? You know, maybe the suggestions will start flying once the world's calmed down a bit.
Right, because you certainly have what,
allowed to get into those creative, you know, you get into those creative mindsets. You know, you need to be able to do it. You know, and at the moment it's not 100%, is it? So we have to just motor on the best we can.
All right. Anything we haven't talked about, Mick, you'd like to let your listeners here in America know?
No, but I would like to thank all the American fans. You know, we came out and did a great tour. Not so long ago with Judas Priest, and we played to all their metal fans, and it was fantastic. We decided to leave all our quiet stuff and our acoustic stuff alone and just go out and hit them with the first number to the last, you know, like a roller coaster tank, if you like.
All right.
And it worked very well, and even Rob Halford was very, very gracious to say, you know, our fans are the hardest fans in the world to please. We've had many support bands, but you're winning over bucket loads by the night, and it's brilliant.
So excellent.
No better accolade than that.
That's true. In fact, Rob will be joining us on Tuesday, December 8th. He's got a brand new book out, and we'll be having Rob on here.
Funny enough, I've just bought it, and I'm just reading it now.
I just got a copy myself. I'm just getting ready to crack the cover on it, so we'll be reading that
too. Confess, yeah?
Yes. You know.
Yeah, mate, yeah.
Maybe, Mick, fantastic, we should start a book club together. I don't know.
Hey, I'm up for that.
There you go. We'll get you back. We'll discuss the book on another date. But
Happy days, my friend.
I do thank you, and go enjoy your dinner, and appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for your support, and to all our American fans. Let's hope we see you soon.
Sooner than later. 50 years
take care,
in rock.
My friend. Happy days.
Happy days to you. 50 years in rock. What a testimony to the talent and the longevity and the quality of Uriah Heep, one of the big, big bands of the era. You know, everybody always talks about Zeppelin and Deep Purple and, of course, Black Sabbath and the various bands. Sometimes you tend to say, well, Uriah Heep should be in there, and they certainly should. They have as rich a catalog as any of those other bands I mentioned, and start sharing that. Go buy this box set, maybe, and share it with your younger friends, and turn them on to great songs like this closing track we're going to play. One of Mick's picks. I like that. Mick's picks. And it's from the box set. This goes back a ways. It is Sweet Lorraine. Coming up, we've got Shamika Copeland, Chicago's Queen of the Blues, joining us to talk about her new album, Uncivil War. But right now, let's say goodbye to Mick with Sweet Lorraine.
Sweet Lorraine, let the party carry on. You and I.
One of the classics in the catalog, the canon of great music from Uriah Heep, one of England's finest exports to the rock and roll world. Like I said, you always hear about Black Sabbath and Deep Purple and Led Zeppelin, and rightfully so. But let's not forget the amazing Uriah Heep and Mr. Mick Box, co-founding member, a member since 1969. And at age 73, 74, he is still going strong. Health is with him, thank goodness. And he's continuing to record and hopefully touring once we get through COVID. He's looking forward to getting back on the road, and we're looking forward to hopefully having him come back here to the colonies, if you will.